Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening this morning. In Nashville, Southern Baptists are convening for what is likely to be a tumultuous four-day convention. Earlier this month, just weeks before the convention, a searing letter written by one of the SBC's most influential leaders, now resigned, was leaked. And it touched off a wildfire of recrimination and criticism and defensiveness. Russell Moore, who once served as president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, accused the church hierarchy of covering up sexual abuse and harassment, of tolerating the assault of women and then ignoring or undermining the women who reported it, and of resisting any attempts towards racial reconciliation. Today, we're focused specifically on why Southern Baptist Church leadership insists on looking the other way on these cases and indeed a wider culture of sexual assault and harassment, instead of reacting with compassion and self-examination. Peter Wehner, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, wrote recently in The Atlantic, "In their eagerness to defend their faith, many Christians refuse to look honestly at the crises American Christendom faces and the corruption within its ranks. They prefer to present to the world a spiritual Potemkin village, projecting an image of righteousness that hides some disturbing realities." So as our guests join us this morning, I'd like to hear from you. How has your faith community, evangelical or otherwise, responded to allegations and concerns about sexual harassment and abuse? Are they practicing the kind of soul-searching that is urgent and necessary in this moment? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and you can tweet in at CarrieMPR. Mary DeMuth is a speaker and author of a number of books, including We Too, How the Church Can Respond Redemptively to the Sexual Abuse Crisis. And with us from Dallas, and Mary, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here today.
Jules Woodson is with us. She's an SBC sexual assault survivor. She is an advocate. She's been speaking out, and she's with us today from Colorado Springs, Colorado. And Jules, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Mary, you wrote an essay earlier this month under the headline, "I Feel Used," that said you'd shared your own story of abuse at the SBC convention 2 years ago, believing that it would be a catalyst for change. And then you write, "I nonetheless feel like I was part of a reactionary PR machine responding to the very real trauma of sexual abuse and cover-up in our midst. While I'm grateful for a response in corporate repentance, as well as the formation of the Caring Well initiative, I have a valid fear that the powers that be will tuck that all away in favor of blindly moving forward." What happened to you after you went public?
Well, I will say, first of all, just thank you to Jules for sharing her story, because hers is definitely within the SBC. My own personal abuse story happened when I was a little kid. And so that was quite a long time ago. And I've got some kind of prophetic distance from that story. But afterwards, and after being at the SBC and also at the Caring Well conference, I had hope, and perhaps it was a naive hope, that things were finally turning around. And what we've seen in the past 2 years has been kind of this scrambling to change reputation, or to prefer reputation over truth. And it has gone down to the deepest levels of the SBC, where they would rather protect reputation and kind of say, okay, yeah, we addressed that, and we've dealt with it. We're going to move on, but now, you know, we're just going to kind of repair our reputation. Well, what happens when you do that is those who are being abused even today are not getting the proper help, and they are still often categorized as truth tellers, but in a negative way. And so people who come forward are maligned, and the powers that be are still trying to protect their reputation.
So, Jules, is that your perception as well, where the church hierarchy would like to do a few superficial mea culpas, but they are quite concerned about protecting the reputation of the people who have been accused, mostly, well, all men, as far as I understand, in the SBC?
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned the word hierarchy, because that's one of the problems that we're bumping up against when addressing these issues in the SBC, is they've really said, we don't have a hierarchy. Every church is autonomous. And so, therefore, they throw their hands up and say, it's not my problem. We don't have a say in how each individual church handles, you know, a sexual abuse claim or a cover-up, because they are autonomous. So we're seeing at every level, not only, you know, individual churches, but, you know, all the way up to the national convention, that there is a lack of true accountability, and most certainly based on protecting their positions of power and their reputation.
I know we talked about this when you were with us around a year ago. I want to say for listeners, they can read details of your account and some of the things that you've talked about and explained about this. I just want to say that your sexual abuse occurred when you were 17, and it does appear that the church was really concerned that the man that you'd accused, and ultimately who apologized for what he had done, although I don't think he ever called it sexual abuse, got a lot of support and protection polishing from the church that he belonged to. How would you put it?
That's absolutely right. And that was true 20 years ago when I reported my abuse. They did finally, after many, many missteps, allowed him to resign. They threw him a going away party, supported him wholeheartedly. And then 20 years later, when I went public with my story, he received a standing ovation from his congregation for essentially admitting to the sexual assault. He very much minimized it, talked about how it was 20 years ago. You're exactly right. He didn't call it sexual abuse. So there was many difficult things to hear in his quote apology, so to speak, but yeah, got a standing ovation.
Mary, I guess I'm trying to figure this out. Is this? I mean, and it is. It's so confusing. I mean, is this? Hey, that could are the church leaders saying that could be me, and that would be a terrible place to be in, and I don't believe these accounts. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out why this is the reaction. I know you've done a lot of thinking about this. Give me some insight.
Yeah, I do think you're onto something there. And I'm, of course, not saying that all pastors who pardon a sexual abuser have a skeleton in their closet, because that's certainly not true. But I think there is this widespread misunderstanding of what sexual abuse is, and especially the power dynamic that's inherently there within a power structure of pastor to congregant. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, we're seeing a lot of times, and we've seen this in several cases within the SBC, of them saying, well, that person who had power over the other person, the person that was abused by them, is actually guilty of an affair. When in actuality, when there is that power differential and you have someone who's the pastor of you or the seminary professor of you, and they're preying upon you, that is not a consensual affair. That is a predatory action.
Absolutely.
And so we have to redefine that. And I think that does scare some. And it helps keep us on our toes. I think for anyone in leadership, we have to take heed lest we fall. But I also think there's just a huge misunderstanding in the church today about what trauma is. And we really are guilty of what, and the SBC is guilty of this as are many denominations. We're guilty of the happy world syndrome. We want to believe that in our particular context, everything is joyful and happy and perfect and light and goodness. We look out to the big bad world and say, yeah, well, and Protestants have pointed to the Catholics. Oh, well, they had it in theirs, but it won't be in ours because I want to have a happy world. And so when we have someone come forward like Jules that upsets the apple cart of our happy world, instead of taking it to heart and doing something about it and reevaluating and repenting and all those things, we keep our happy world and we villainize someone like Jules. It's easier to do that than to do the hard work of repentance.
Will called in and couldn't stay, but he says, I went to an SBC church when I lived in Louisville, Kentucky, which is where the SBC has a seminary. There were a couple of charges of sexual abuse at the church during my time there, and they were handled well. The investigation was handed over to the authorities. It wasn't something the church was trying to hide or even take on themselves. Jules, are there examples? Because again, you said that the argument is, well, these churches are independent. They'll handle this. Hey, we, the hierarchy, what can we do about this? Are there some examples where the churches get it and are handling this in a way that you and Mary and others would say, that's the model?
Sure. I do think that there are examples of churches who handle this well. Obviously, one of the first things we would say is any sort of sexual abuse between a pastor and a congregant is criminal because of the power differential. And so we would say, absolutely, this needs to be reported to the authorities, to the proper authorities, police. And then the church also has a responsibility about how they will handle it. Unfortunately, we see a lot of times where they allow pastors to resign. Mm-hmm. That's frustrating as a survivor. Anytime you have someone that does something, you know, a criminal act, to allow them to just simply resign, I feel like is letting them go off the hook real easily. If you had something like that in the corporate world, they would immediately be fired. I do think with talking about it and everything, there are people that are educating themselves on the right response, but there's so much more that needs to be learned and adopted, you know, at policy levels between individual churches and, you know, all the way up the denomination.
Which is what this convention ought to be about, and we'll come back to that in a minute. I want to hear from Steve in Stanchfield. Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for calling back.
Thank you.
Good to have you on the phone. Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to say that this shouldn't be surprising. This is absolutely nothing new. I mean, I left any organized Christian religion many decades ago. I'm 68 years old now, just because when this stuff started to come out, and the Southern Baptist is no different than the Catholic Church. They're hierarchical. They don't allow women to serve as ministers or priests. They hide this, and it's not just misogyny. It's also child abuse. I kind of follow that as almost as a hobby. And this has been going on for a long, long time. The Jehovah Witnesses are involved. Every organized religion just about has this massive problem that they're almost doing nothing to address. So I don't know why this is even surprising.
It's interesting, Steve, because I wondered, Mary, why the Southern Baptists didn't see the moral authority that the Catholic Church ceded when it refused to be open and transparent about the sexual abuse of children, why the SBC didn't say that is an extremely dangerous cautionary tale. I mean, what's your sense of that?
It's always easier to point the finger at somebody else than it is to point it back at yourself. And so, yes, it's very easy to say, well, they did it wrong, but that's not us. When in reality, I think the caller is correct. Because this world is full of mess and there are predators all over in every scope of society, then as institutions and as churches, it's our responsibility to say that as the bottom line. They exist, so how should we respond? I'm reminded of a church in Houston. Nathan Leno was the pastor, and he found out about a sexual abuse thing that happened in his church from a youth pastor. And what he did was astounding. So, of course, they reported it to the authorities, and then he held a press conference.
Wow.
And he called all the local stations to come and said, "We missed it. We failed. We're sorry. We fired him, obviously." And they did like all of the steps that I would say are best practices. And so when I think about people leaving the church, like the caller who did, I think when they see something like that, they're more attracted to, yes, it happened. We're grieved by it. We're going to try to do better than someone who just covers it up, shuffles the person to some other place, just as the Catholic Church did, and pretends that it doesn't exist. That's not life-giving, and that's not truth-telling.
Discussion this morning as members of the Southern Baptist Church community meet for a convention in Nashville, and it promises to be a pretty tumultuous few days down there, because going into the convention, a letter that the person who once served as president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission has been released, and it is deeply, deeply critical and harsh about the way the churches, individual churches, and the church hierarchy have handled or basically ignored these allegations of sexual abuse among women. Russell Moore also comments on race. This hour, we are focused on this issue of sexual assault and sexual abuse. This is something the church has known about for a long time. Mary DeMuth is with us. She's a speaker and she's the author of a number of books, and they include We Too, How the Church Can Respond Redemptively to the Sexual Abuse Crisis. And Jules Woodson is back with us. She is a sexual assault survivor and an advocate. And I'm asking you this morning how your faith community, whether it's evangelical or not, has responded to allegations and concerns about sexual harassment and abuse. As women, is your church community practicing the kind of soul searching that is really urgent and necessary in this moment? Does your church leader, pastor, whoever leads your church, talk about this from the pulpit? Do you get a sense that there is open and transparency about this in your own faith community? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet in at @CarrieMPR. Jules, I wanted to come back to something that Mary said earlier, which is the church doesn't know what trauma is. I'm really eager to hear how that strikes you and what that means, if it's true.
Oh, I think Mary is spot on. And as a survivor who has been not only advocating for justice within my own story, but for all survivors within the SBC over the last couple of years, we're seeing this problem time and time again. So in 2019, I spoke with you guys actually while I was at the convention in Birmingham.
Right.
They made a lot of charges that they were going to be actively, you know, moving forward and addressing the issue of sexual abuse within the SBC. They created the Credentials Committee, which was to determine whether a church was in friendly cooperation with the SBC based on how they've handled sexual abuse allegations. And over the last few years, it's been stunning. We are finding out that the people that were tasked on this committee have not had 1 ounce of training or education regarding sexual abuse and trauma. They were literally just thrown out there and said, "Good luck dealing with this." And I look back and I say, okay, well, then the executive committee who created you know, and is kind of tasked with being in charge of the credentials committee is responsible. At some point, there has got to be accountability. And yes, we are seeing, which is why us survivors are trying to speak out. We are seeing so many people that aren't trauma informed think that they know how to handle this appropriately.
Mary, if you look at the text of the letter, I'm sure you've both parsed it very carefully. You see that Russell, and I know he's written two letters. I'm talking about the big long one, the one that came first. You know, his words are really critical and urgent. He talks about the behind the scenes contempt among church leaders for women who have come forward with accounts of sexual abuse. And he writes, "I'm trying to say this as clearly as I can, brothers and sisters. These are the tactics that have been used to create a culture where countless children have been torn to shreds and where women have been raped and broken down." I guess I'm trying to understand how, when someone from within who held the kind of influence and the kind of position that he did rings the alarm like that, the church doesn't see that as a gathering storm of epic proportions. What did they think was going to happen?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say that, as I mentioned earlier, it is sadly the powers that be are more interested in reputation management than they are in righteousness and doing the right thing. And so anything that tarnishes an image, even though it's true, is going to cause them to circle the wagons. And that's, I think, what Jules was hinting at. Like, we did have some hope at the last SBC convention. There was like, there were things going to happen, but we didn't know that we were fighting against some hierarchies and some leadership positions that were flat out against any sort of transparency, any sort of teachability about trauma and sexual abuse. And they were all about kind of returning to what happened in the 80s and 90s, the conservative resurgence within the denomination. They felt that just like in race, they felt like this issue and race was it was an antithesis to the gospel. I would argue the opposite is true. To treat people well, to listen to people who have been harmed, to hang out with people and dignify the stories of those who have been broken is precisely the thing that Jesus would do. And so I am confounded by all the politicking. I'm confounded by preserving reputation over the cries of people who have been victimized. It literally makes no sense to me. And when I see Jesus in the Gospels, I see him hanging out with the marginalized and the broken, and I see him reserving the most poignant and pointed words to those in authority who are still trying to cull that authority and keep it at any cost.
Call from Heather in Lauderdale. Hi, Heather. Thanks so much for calling in.
Yes. Hello. Preach it, sisters. My goodness. This is just really essential conversation on something that I've experienced myself. And I, at an academic level, working at an evangelical institution in the cities that takes quite a few very conservative political stances, I experienced over the course of 10 years what started out as like rumors of sexual impropriety between professors and students. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the closer I got to having evidence of this, the more I was the Cassandra, the canary in the coal mine, right? That is, yeah, not valued, right? And I feel as though this like legacy of being a truth teller has actually marked my career as an artist as well, with a scarlet letter from the conservative community. And currently I self-identify as ex-evangelical. Mm-hmm. I love that has some great distance from any sort of politicalization of of all of this. I mean, like, the president of the university I worked at was also a lobbyist in Washington on super conservative issues.
Yeah. Heather,
you know, like,
you raise,
so systemic.
I'm really glad you've raised your own experience as I left the church. I hear you saying that. And Jules, that's what I wonder is, you know, the church would be forced to change if people said, this is intolerable and I'm not going to belong and give money to a church that behaves this way. So far, I don't see a mass movement towards that. What are you seeing?
Well, honestly, I've seen some data coming out that the Southern Baptists have truly been struggling these last few years and have lost many members. And unfortunately, you know, I as a survivor can be crying out, joining hands with other survivors. But until it hits their pocketbooks, it seems that they will not do a thing. And the caller just mentioned that this is a systemic problem. And I want to touch on that for a second. I truly believe, and many of us survivors do, this is a systemic issue. There have been ways, and Mary touched on this with the conservative resurgence in the SBC, ways that they have set up their culture that that protects white men in power. It disables women from being any part of the conversation or whatnot. And they've created this system that protects abusers and abusive people. And until we see them being willing to change this at an institutional systemic level, I just don't see true redemption coming forward.
We're going to get a look at the latest news when we come back with Mary DeMuth and Jules Woodson. I want to ask them about what they think of the larger debate going on about what it means to be evangelical in America today. I'd be curious about your thoughts on that as well. Mary DeMuth and Jules Woodson with us as we continue the conversation, and a call from Christian in Minneapolis. Christian, it sounds like you are a local pastor. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, I am.
What denomination are you in?
Yeah, I'm a part of the Evangelical Covenant Church.
Glad to have your call. Tell me what you're thinking of our discussion.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of contributing factors. I think one of the questions I heard people asking was, how does this remain silent for so long?
Yes.
And, I think in a theological context, one of the issues that I think happens is we see wrongdoing or sin, whatever, brokenness, whatever way you want to talk about it, as simply an individual issue and not a systemic issue. And so what you hear preached about is only your own individual sin, but not the sort of bigger systemic issues like male privilege or, you know, racism, like we've mentioned here before as well, or even just, you know, power dynamics that, I mean, there's just decades of society working the way it's working, and that doesn't necessarily make it right. But when you start to, I think, take Jesus' teachings and challenge that from a systemic perspective, a lot of people get really uncomfortable with that because they don't see it as sin, and you're just sort of upsetting the apple cart. And so there's years that for someone like who's been taught that women don't have a voice or don't have the same power or authority given to them by the Holy Spirit, which is what I've come to believe, that they don't feel like they have a voice in being able to contribute to any of these things. And so, you know, I think that's one of the factors from a theological perspective, from a culture setting perspective. Those are the things that I think contribute significantly.
Pastor, I just have a question for you. Do you sense that your congregation wants to hear from you on some of the things you've just said and that we're talking about this hour? Or is that another version of upsetting the apple cart and making people really uncomfortable?
No, I think as a leader, the church is hoping for clarification on what's happening in culture. And, you know, what does that mean in regards to the Bible? And how do we understand the current happenings of today to what Jesus would have to say about it, you know, and you have to approach that really prayerfully and carefully because, I mean, as a leader, you have influence. And so, one, I think even just my presence as being a woman in leadership, mm-hmm. I mean, the little girls see that and get to see that modeled to them, not just spoken from stage. And so the more different voices that you can have on stage speaking what I think is truth, it's so important to be able to see that. And I think, yes, I personally am going into studying more around marriage and family therapy, around mental health, because I want to decrease the stigma about some of this, you know, trauma work that we're talking about
right,
and some
right.
of these that happen not only on a systemic church level, but in people's lives, in their workplaces, in their families. One out of three people are sexually abused growing up, you know, have that. And so it's like, how do you say that from stage so that people can then feel comfortable if something like that has happened in their own personal life, let alone hopefully not, but unfortunately it happens in the church settings as well.
Yeah, I'm really glad for your call. Mary, will you reflect for a minute on what the pastor has said and then also think about what I asked, whether congregations are ready for this and want it?
Well, I think they're hungering for it. And one of the things that I write about in my book is I can count on one hand in 20 plus years of being in church how many times a sermon about sexual abuse has ever been preached. And in fact, usually on that hand, I'm the person preaching it. So I just have not experienced it. And here's what I have, you know, heard from pastors. They want to-ish, but the first thing they'll say to me is, if I talk about this, the floodgates will open and people will finally come out of the woodwork and say, yes, me too, me too, me too. My point is that not the job of a shepherd? Not that you take on everybody's pain because nobody could sustain that. But on my website, wetoo.org, I have a whole thing about all sorts of resources all over the world. And so if you were a pastor giving a talk about sexual abuse and just preaching from the Bible, because it's in there, you could have all those resources available to your congregation. You could have people at the ready. You could have referrals to counseling centers. All those things could be in place. I would argue that is that not a shepherd's job to shepherd most of the people in that room who have had a sexual abuse experience? I am overwhelmed and so sad, and I continue to raise my voice and say, it has to be done. I'm preaching a little bit here, but I felt like I was a weirdo and an outcast for almost all of my, you know, formative years as a Christ follower because nobody shared my story from the front. I thought I was the only one. And so my job now, and I'm sure Jules's job as well, is to share the story so people no longer feel alone. But boy, there's a lot of broken people in the pews suffering under years of complex post-traumatic stress syndrome who don't feel seen or heard or mentioned or even as if they exist. And I am over it.
You know, Jules, one of the things that really struck me and hasn't gotten much attention in what Russell Moore wrote is his concern about young evangelicals. And all denominations need to worry about how younger Americans are pulling away from faith communities. I mean, Moore wrote that young evangelicals are, quote, walking away from evangelicalism, not because they do not believe what the church teaches, but because they believe the church itself does not believe what the church teaches. Boy, that is a spear right in the heart of, you know, I guess, caring for the church into decades and decades to come, right? For keeping the church vital. He's saying, you know, you are losing the next generation. What do you think?
Oh, I think that's very true. And to piggyback on what Mary said, you know, Jesus was there for the wounded and the vulnerable. I mean, that is one of the greatest messages of the gospel. And when the church, you know, they preach these stories, but when they cannot demonstrate the very love that God showed to the wounded,
It is a catastrophe, and I don't blame people for walking away. There is a history of how they have handled this. And when you talk to the younger generations, they care about these issues, social justice,
right,
racism, women and you know, men in power and all of these things. These are issues that the younger generation absolutely cares about. And so until the church is not only willing to demonstrate, you know, with tangible action, you know, that these are things they care about too, I don't see it changing. I see younger people walking away.
Call from Kay in Owatonna. Hi, Kay. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, thanks. I'm sorry to sort of veer this back toward the Catholic Church scandals, but they just beg comparisons. But I was a newspaper reporter who was contacted by a very wealthy white man who was a significant donor to the Catholic Church, the diocese in Winona, to the tune of about $1 million a year he gave. He was a very significant donor.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also very, very troubled by the allegations and claims and proof of sexual assault within the church. And so that man provided me, he called me and said, I have a story for you. And again, long story short here, what I uncovered and what I found prompted the Vicar General of the Winona Diocese to step down,
mm-hmm,
because it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I'm telling you, it was an old white man who had a lot of money who prompted that.
He forced the church to pay attention, I think you're saying, Kay,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And so, you know, it does come down to the money. When they start withholding, because, of course, the church officials came to him and said, gee, Joe, why aren't you donating all the money anymore? And he said, because I'm tired of the sexual abuse claims, and you're using my money for your lawsuits. I don't want it. And
wow,
they kind of, you know, just wrung their hands and, oh, gee, we're sorry. And that was not satisfactory to him. And he came to me and he said, I'm stopping this.
And he forced change. Yeah,
he did. He did. And so, unfortunately, as with many things, the white men had their say, and also money did. And so I hate that that is the answer, or part of the answer, but, you know, honestly, that's just the way it is. And so the more the SBC can get folks with money to stop doing that and to force some change, hopefully that would be the ticket, or part of it anyway.
It raises, thank you, Kay, it raises something that I wanted to come back to, Mary, which is this debate that's going on about what it means to be an evangelical in America today. Of course, that has political implications as well. But I was reading something that Baylor University historian Thomas Kidd said to The Atlantic on this. In American pop culture parlance, evangelical now basically means whites who consider themselves religious and who vote Republicans. And I guess my question for that is the church pretty quietly comfortable with that? Are they okay with that? And that is why there's so much resistance to change.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It depends upon, you know, we have a wide variety of different churches throughout the United States and the world. So it's hard to say that that's 100% true of every church. But I think a lot of us are becoming uncomfortable with that word. It used to mean one thing. It means something else now.
Evangelical, you mean? Yeah.
Yes, evangelical. It used to mean someone who believed the words of the Bible and lived according to its principles, basically, which in itself kind of sounds a little haughty, you know, like, well, and those people over there don't. But I think in its purest form, that's what it meant. Now, when people use that term, it exactly means what the professor at Baylor said. And so I have to kind of go back to, I don't like that label of myself. And so I kind of go back to, I'm just going to look at the historical Christian faith through the years, through the decades and centuries, and align myself there, not with this kind of made up label that has now become politicized so much that it's mm-hmm. causing people to be hurt and broken. And I don't want to be a part of that.
Jules, what do you think is going to happen at the convention?
Oh, well, it's definitely going to be an interesting day. So yesterday, Jared Wellman, a member of the executive committee, brought forth a motion to basically have the executive committee investigation. It's kind of funny, but they've essentially hired a firm and are managing how the firm investigates themselves. So very interesting.
Wow.
But Jared Wellman's motion, as a member, said, hey, we want to talk about this. I want to talk about this. I want to have more transparency within this process. It got voted down just to even have the conversation about it. So today is a big day because there are two motions being brought forth, one by Gaines and Parrott, and one by Todd Benkart. And so the Gaines and Parrott motion essentially is going to look at opening up this investigation that the executive committee has already assigned to guidepost and to broaden the scope to include the credentials committee, to include a lot more people that were a part of all of this leadership and whatnot. They're looking at having the executive committee waive privileges so that they're essentially not in charge of the investigation into themselves. And then another big important thing is to have a public report. When the investigation is done, every single SBC member deserves to know what the report said. And so that's going on. And then Todd Benkart's motion is going to be regarding a denominational audit with regards to sexual abuse and the mishandling of sexual abuse. So
that could be
two huge things to be watching for today.
I want to take a call here from Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for waiting. Tell me what you wanted to add to this.
Yeah, I just really wanted to add the need to root this in colonization. You can look at Christopher Columbus's journals, and he talks about his men going out looking for 9- and 10-year-old indigenous girls to what we would now call sex traffic. And sexual abuse of women and children, boys and girls, is essentially central to the formation of this country, particularly in the way that indigenous people have been and continue to be targeted in that. And the church and the U.S. government run boarding schools were central to that. And our communities are still dealing with that intergenerational trauma that has occurred because of that. And as a Native woman, I would just really ask that this conversation be extended to include the historical context and the ongoing legacy of colonization and the ways that sexual violence, the ways that rape of Native women and children continues to devastate our communities. I just want to point out that in Canada recently, two boarding schools were found, one with 215 mass graves of children and another with 100 and some mass graves of children. And people can get more information about this by Googling the Truth and Reconciliation Report out of Canada.
Okay.
And those Canadian boarding schools and U.S. boarding schools were run in the exact same way. So I just wanted to ask to please extend this to the Native communities and other communities of colors in the ways that we have been particularly targeted and vulnerable to this. Thank you.
I thank you for the call, Chris. As I was listening to Chris, Mary, I was thinking, I don't know how much confidence we can have in, you know, specifically in the Southern Baptist, but in many of these faiths to do the kind of inquiry about their historical implications, as Chris is noting, when they can't even manage contemporary allegations that ought to be investigated, you know, in this moment. I'd love your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm watching Canada these days because they are really trying to do the right thing in this particular instance, as not only uncovering what has happened in those Indigenous schools, but thinking of how to apologize and how to tell the truth and reparations and all of that. I think it's a good example for all of us. And I tweeted something today. I said, I don't know how to change an institution. I do know how to pray and I do know how to act, but it can be very overwhelming for those of us sitting in the middle of those institutions as a small person and a small cog in a very large machine to know even how to do that. But the only thing I know how to do is to keep talking and to keep sharing and to keep the pressure up so that these institutions will do pass some of these resolutions. I'm not confident that today the SBC will, but if they did, I would be very encouraged. And all we can do is just keep speaking up. So I want to publicly commend Jules for her, at great cost to her heart, at great cost to her soul. She has continued to speak out about this issue, and for not for her glory, but for the sake of those who do not have the strength to share because of their trauma.
Mary, just briefly, given Jules, you know, insight for us and what's coming on the convention, do you have hope that there will be, you know, some kind of serious push for transparency when this convention concludes, that this is going to be transformational in some ways?
It is completely dependent upon who the leaders are. And if the leaders are the same that they have been, unfortunately, I am losing hope. And that has broken my heart.
You're losing hope because you don't see a push for different kind of leadership?
I see it from the base, but I don't see it from the top. And as the other caller mentioned about the white man who gave a lot of money, that's where the change happens in these kinds of topward down systems. Mm-hmm. And until the money stops, I don't know if things will change.
I thank you both for a really insightful conversation. Jules, Mary, thank you. Mary DeMuth is a speaker and author of a number of books, including We Too, How the Church Can Respond Redemptively to the Sexual Abuse Crisis. And Jules Woodson is an SBC sexual assault survivor and an advocate. I would recommend, if you're interested in these issues, Googling these letters that Russell Moore wrote to the leadership of the SBC. The first one is comprehensive and well worth looking at. You can just go online and Google it and see where the controversy lies here with the SBC. Finally, some news about this show. For 17 years, this has been a place for lively, fact-based discussions, for civil debates, and for candid conversations about national and international events. We've brought people with strong points of view, compelling ideas, rich imaginations, and captivating narratives to the air. And then we've opened the phone lines and invited you into the mix. And your questions and observations have deepened every discussion I've led. But the M in Minnesota Public Radio is there for a reason. And MPR has decided to sharpen its focus on our state and our community, to go all in, if you will, on this Minnesota community that we're all a part of. So on August 6th, we'll end these conversations about national and international events. I'll begin a new Friday show about books and big ideas. And Angela Davis will bring her call-in show about Minnesota to 9 a.m. Angela's a longtime friend. I'll be supporting her in every way I can, and I hope you'll listen in. Meanwhile, I've emerged from these months of the pandemic with an appetite for change, and change is good. So I'll be following my curiosity into new endeavors, both inside NPR and beyond. Until then, we've got more shows coming about science and politics, education, books, and more. And I hope you'll listen and join in.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.